All right, so our second speaker this morning is Professor George Smith, who's in the philosophy department at Tufts University. He served for, I think it was 5 years, as the director of the Dibner Institute for the History of Science at MIT. He is one of the world's leading scholars on Isaac Newton and the Principia in particular. And today he'll be speaking to us on the topic, How Much Did She See? Du Châtelet's Commentary on Newton's Principia. Please join me in welcoming Professor Smith.
Thank you. I'm quite confident that I know less about Du Châtelet than any of the other speakers. Most of what I know came either from conversations with Bernard Cohen, who greatly admired her translation. For 13 years, once a week, Bernard Cohen and I had lunch and talked only about, most of the time, only about Newton and related. And then from Judith Zinsser's book, and prior to that, the paper she published in 2001, which has long been part of my Newton course. I wouldn't even be here today if Jean-Marie Muska had not decided as her research project in my Newton course in 2012 to translate the first 115 pages of the commentary of Du Châtelet. And it was only after that that I started looking at it, and much of what I'm going to say today is possible only because she, who is very much here, because she put me in a position to do so. The Du Châtelet work on Newton sits right in the middle, historically, of an enormous transition in the continental attitude toward Newton's theory of gravity. Starting in 1732, Maupertuis, in a publication that gets reissued, as you see, and translated in English as well, in so many words said, enough of this dead-end philosophic controversy over Newton. Let's just stop the philosophy and let the empirical world decide whether he's right or not. And proposes the two expeditions, one to the north, one to the equator, to let that decide the matter. I'll come back to the results of those. Between 1732 and 21 years later, when Mayer publishes a version of Euler's theory of the moon that for the first time in human history actually had a description of lunar motion that was reasonably accurate enough that he won half of the prize, we have a complete transformation in the evidence for Newton's Newtonian theory. Much of it, as you see there, roughly halfway down, other than the so-called Jesuit edition, the 1739-1742, much of it is tied very heavily to the figure of the Earth. I'll talk about that later. There are a couple comments worth making here, though, besides just the expedition. The Clairaut paper in 1738, I think it was first published in English, as a matter of fact, calls attention to a fundamental error that Newton had made, and that then led to his 1743 book, Theory of the Figure of the Earth, which is to this day the seminal work on this topic. And she knew that work quite well. In fact, as far as I can see, she knew everything on this slide up to 1743, except perhaps the Maclaurin. The Maclaurin two volumes were translated into French very, very immediately because they reconciled Leibnizian and Newtonian calculus. So they were a very big deal. I don't know for sure whether she had access. All the rest of this slide she almost certainly had no access to, except perhaps conversations she had with Clairaut. In particular, the real turning point in the history of evidence for Newton's theory occurred in 1749 with two publications. The first, I brought these in case anybody wants to see them during break. The first is the D'Alembert, in which he successfully derives for the first time ever the precession of the equinoxes, the 26,000-year wobble of the Earth. In it, he derides Newton for having just produced a sham of a derivation, which is correct. Newton did not have a derivation, it's a sham. And then goes on to say, for the first time ever, we have clear evidence that the moon acts on the Earth because the tides are so messy you could not infer it before. But henceforth, thanks to D'Alembert, we're going to have, henceforth we know the moon acts on the Earth. As far as I can see in reading her, she had zero contact with D'Alembert. She was just totally unaware of what he was doing. There's no reference in there that's consistent with anything he did in the 1740s. I can't imagine why she didn't read his treatise on dynamics, but for some reason or other, I can't find any sign of it anywhere. Then the other great work, 1749, just briefly, Newtonian theory was only able to produce half of the mean motion of the lunar apogee. It's the biggest, most glaring loose end in the Principia, as Newton himself was well aware, and it had been announced in England in 1729 as part of the English translation of the Principia. Clairaut himself had concluded that Newtonian theory is inadequate, and it said you need to modify the law of gravity to accommodate the motion of the moon. But then he went back and looked at his own calculations and included second order effects and got right on the motion of the lunar apse. When Euler heard about it, he sent a letter to Clairaut saying, this is the greatest discovery in the history of astronomy. That's literally the greatest discovery in the history of astronomy. For only now do we know that the inverse square definitely holds. And in his 1753 second prize-winning account of the motion of Jupiter and Saturn, he says that in the preface to that book, after what Clairaut did, henceforth we can just be confident that if anything does not fit Newton's law of gravity, anything celestial, the problem is ours. We don't know how to calculate it. We should quit worrying about the truth of it. And he says much the same thing in the 1754 theory of the moon. So those two works, the two 1749 events, are the turning point in the history of continental attitudes and even a substantial change in England itself. And of course, she knew neither of those. She died before she was aware of either of those. And that, needless to say, makes a substantial part of her commentary, which appeared first in 1756, made it, in effect, obsolete before it appeared. I'm going to show some very good things about those two results at the same time. Now, there are a number of other commentaries on the Principia at the time. I could have filled four slides with these, but these are the ones that are actually worth mentioning. She had to have had David Gregory's 1702 work, which is probably the most outspoken publication against Leibniz's account of celestial motion, showing it's internally inconsistent, or at least claiming to show that. She had at least one of the two Kyle books. I don't know whether she had both. And they're very different. The first Kyle book is much more about Huygens and mechanics than it is about Newtonian astronomy. She definitely had the Zgravesande, which is a quite beautiful book. If I brought my computer, you could all look at it today. She obviously knew about Voltaire. And then she had the Sieur Jacques Calandrino commentary before her, and I'm going to come right back to that. And as far as I can see, she probably had the Lacaille, but I don't see anything in her writings that make it clear that she had the Lacaille. The Lacaille got translated in English in 1750. It was still in print in the 1830s. It became a very substantial reference topic. Now, go back to the Le Sieur Jacques Calandrino. This is one page from it. I didn't bring my copy today because it's a little bit beat up. My copy's from 1832. It stayed in print through 1832. It's a Glasgow edition. It was originally three volumes. This is a particularly important proposition that I will come back to, Proposition 92, where Newton proposes how to use an experimental program to show that gravitational attraction is proportional to the mass of the attracting body. And it's a very important element that he finally included late in 1685. The other two things I wanted to call your attention to, if you notice the asterisk at the footnote, That means it's Calandrino, not Lesueur or Jacquier. Almost all the mathematically interesting commentary in this work is by Calandrino, who was a first-rate mathematician, not by Lesueur and Jacquier. The other thing to notice is the number of words. I've not counted, but the number of words in commentary all in this form, a footnote, is somewhere between 3 and 10 times as many words as in the Principia. It is enormously more vast than the Principia itself. So from the time that was published, everybody had means of access to each proposition of the Principia. In many cases, it gives a very careful explanation of the mathematics, and in some cases, it relates it to things before Newton that he does not bother to relate it to, particularly the work of Huygens. So they're constantly pointing out the links to prior work. One of the things Bernard used to do, and I've picked up the habit now, is when students come to me in need of money, if they happen to have Latin, I have them translate parts of this. So I have roughly half of the commentary translated by somewhere around 20 or 30 students over a 50-year period, but it's very far from putting it out or anything. But it's just an immense commentary. Now, she had that in front of her while translating and commenting. Okay. Her access to de Châtelet's works, I relied partly or heavily on Judith. The only thing I add that I have a slight advantage on her, de Châtelet doesn't say that she's writing about Newton's 1702 theory of the moon, but what she does is list the 6 steps in it and then criticize it for just the right reasons, namely there's no explanation at all for why Newton is doing these things. You'll see it in a few moments. And that came out as a small English pamphlet in English translation. But the original is an appendix to Gregory, and I'm pretty sure she had the Gregory and saw it there. I don't know for sure. Now, there are 2 comments to make about this slide that are very important about the position she was in. She twice in the commentary cites first edition, but there's no sign she had access to the first edition. She must have got it from a review or something like that. To show you why I'm so certain of that, the second edition has 484 pages. 397 of them differ from the first edition. That is, 80% of the pages differ from the first edition. If you want to see what 25 years of second thoughts, it's the title of my paper of mine, 25 years of second thoughts did, it's an enormous transformation. Not so much in substance, there are a few places in substance, but trying to argue place after place, the evidence lies in the future. Several places he encourages people to pick this up and do things. All right, the other thing that is very distortive for her is she did have I don't know if she had the 1728, Judith says the 1731 reprint of what the original version of Book 3 of the Principia. Unfortunately, the editors who put that out changed all the proposition numbers in order to make it look contemporaneous with Book 3 of the Principia, and in the process created a massive distortion, because at the time it was written, roughly, well, I know the number, 45 propositions in Book 1 and 90% of the propositions in Book 2 Newton had not derived yet. So it's a work very early, worked on through April through roughly September of 1685, that led him to go back and substantially modify Book 1, adding just a lot of propositions, then to break out Book 2 as a separate book entirely. So she's looking at that work as if it were contemporaneous with the Principia, that all Newton decided was not to do a publication of the system of the world in the style of Descartes, and instead to do it mathematically, because of course Hooke had claimed priority and Newton was going to be obnoxious, which he certainly was capable of doing. I'm just finishing, and I guess it's already circulating. I know at least Catherine has a copy, and Monica Monica Solomon have copies of this. I've done a variorum translation, meaning all deletions and insertions of System of the World that I hope get to a publisher reasonably soon. I'm having a Latinist review it. It tells you more about how Newton got to the Principia than any other document, particularly the deletions and insertions. It's just remarkable what a difference looking at those makes. She had no access to that. So she's sitting there looking at System of the World, which is very informative regardless, but she's looking at it as if it's contemporary to Book Three. All right, with that as background, this is the contents. I brought the facsimile edition of her 1756 publication for people to look at if they wish during noontime break. They're two large volumes. I'll show you pictures of some of the pages in just a moment, but they're table of contents. Chapter one, she goes fairly far beyond the Principia's list of phenomena to describe a lot of other things that are before Newton. Chapter two is on how Newton gets the law of gravity. Then chapters three through six, you can see what the titles are. And then without a chapter name to it, she has a section called Of Comets. One thing to notice, she totally ignores the general scholium, famous general scholium added to the end of the Principia by Newton in the second edition. So too, almost entirely, de Le Sueur and Jacquier. I'll leave to you why they thought it wasn't worth talking about. I almost have that view personally, so I rarely am willing to talk about it. What's striking here is that part, which is non-mathematical, of her commentary runs 116 pages. Notice what follows. 100 and whatever it is, just under 170 pages of page after page of calculus. Okay, and nobody I know of has looked at that at all. I've started looking at it, but I'm an elderly man. I'm not going to spend the next 10 years of my life going through that. I hope some PhD student will pick it up. Just to show you an example, these are two pages. The page on the right is on a spheroid. It's a problem Newton solves in corollary 2 of proposition 91, the one just before the one I showed you. Newton can't solve for the gravitational field around the spheroid of Earth. He can only solve for it on the axis, what the gravitational attraction is on the axis of revolution. But that's enough for experiment, and that's how he's going to use it for experiment. What's striking about her that's not true in the Calendrino, if you notice, there's an integral sign in hers. She's actually doing it in calculus. Calendrino reproduces this proof in Newton, which is almost impenetrable. I'll just explain that in a moment. But does not do it in the calculus. So she's doing this on her either on her own or in conjunction with Clairaut. I have no way of knowing what is going on between her and Clairaut. Just quick comment. The stuff on the spheroidal Earth in the Principia, Book One, got added in the summer of 1686 when, for the first time, Newton learned from Halley that there was a variation in surface gravity. So it's two inserts while the book was in press. And as a result, they have to be compressed in the right number of pages. And as a result, they're semi-unintelligible. The one on the left, though, is even more impressive. This is one of the most beautiful theorems in all of the Principia. She's doing a special case of it. I'll be quoting her and mentioning this a little later. Newton asked the question, take any trajectory whatsoever celestially, what do you have to do to it so you get the same trajectory, but that trajectory rotating in time, precessing in time? And he made a fundamental discovery. It's absolutely right. If you superpose an inverse cube force on any other force, you get the same trajectory propagating in time. Newton's proof of that is an extremely complicated piece of geometry. She's doing it in calculus, and it's the first place I've ever seen it in calculus. Now, again, I have no way of knowing. In conversation with Clairaut, in fact, I'll make this remark now just to try to make it clear to everybody. I have a 55-year career as an engineer that I just retired from 3 years ago. One of the things I learned in it is whenever any technical subject is being discussed in a conversation and a new idea comes up, it is very nearly impossible to figure out who that idea ought to be attributed to. Because I'm a trained philosopher, I've gotten a lot of credit for things that shouldn't be mine just because I can articulate things. But it's a very messy thing. So if she's in conversation with Clairaut, I am not even willing to speculate on what's her and what's Clairaut, because I don't know how to go about figuring it out. But this piece is a really remarkable piece. It runs about 4 pages, and it's typical. We've got 169 pages like that, save for the one little section on refraction, which is about 6 or 7 pages with no equations. So somebody needs to look at all that. Chapter 2 of her is on Newton's theory of gravitational attraction. I'm going to spend the next few minutes primarily on it. I'm not going to read these out to you. The first principle, the inverse square, Newton establishes independently of any of the others, and has to be established, well, can be established. The second one, that the force is proportional to the mass of the body on which it acts, Newton also establishes independently of any of the others. She doesn't present it that way, but it would quite present it that way, but it's true. The third, fourth, and fifth are the principal loose end in Newton's derivation of the law of gravity. They are interrelated to one another. I'll come back to that, but they are very much tied to one another. It's only in the Principia that he starts talking about a tendency to accelerate toward each body that fills the space surrounding it, what we would call a field. That doesn't show up in the early version of Book 3. Only in the published version. The phrase used is fill the space. And finally, that seventh thing, what he's famous for, throughout the universe, every pair of particles interact. I think you'll have a lot of trouble finding that said anywhere by Newton. Okay? It's not that he didn't agree with it, he just never went around asserting it. And I think you can understand why, because it sounds crazy. In fact, that's what Huygens said about it. It was totally crazy. All right, with that as background, let's start looking at what she does. So this is her account of how Newton gets the inverse square. She starts from the Kepler 3/2 power rule, which a lot of people had started from, including Newton. And now I quote, "The force that draws the planets toward the sun decreases in the inverse ratio of the square of their distance from this celestial body, supposing that they turn in concentric circles about the sun." The idea that presents itself most naturally to the spirit is that they carry out their revolutions in concentric circles, but their apparent diameters and more exact observations made known long ago that their orbits could not be concentric to the sun. Therefore, before Kepler, their course was explained using eccentric circles, which satisfied well enough the observations of the sun and the planets, if we accept Mercury and Mars. Quick comment about that. At the time Newton wrote the Principia, there was no empirical evidence except for Mercury and Mars that could distinguish between eccentric circle and ellipse. The evidence didn't emerge till the 1740s. You need very, very precise observations to be able to tell the difference for any other planet. So she's quite right, but I'm going to flip what she says in just a moment. Quote, "The Keplerian ellipse agrees so perfectly with the phenomenon that it is presently recognized by all astronomers that it is in ellipses that the planets turn around the sun, and that this celestial body occupies one of the foci of these ellipses." In just a moment, you're going to see when she says all astronomers, there was one notable exception. His name was Isaac Newton. Okay, he flatly rejects that, as you'll see in a couple moments. Lacaille does assert it, though, and that's one of the reasons I think she's depending on Lacaille. So starting from this discovery, Mr. Newton searched for the law of centripetal force that is necessary to make the planets describe an ellipse, and he found in Proposition 11 that this force must follow the inverse proportion of the square of the body's distance from the focus of the ellipse, and she adds he then has to check to make sure the three halves power rule holds for ellipses as well. Now, as nicely as I can put it, this is a total distortion of Newton's Principia. It's a distortion that lots of people have made, but she's the only one, besides David Gregory, I can be confident of, who says this and had actually read the book. Okay? What you can see, it's, I know this is hard to see, but I'll just summarize it. On the left is the account Calandrino gives, what the Latin says, starting with accuratissime. Most accurately, however, this part of the proposition, the inverse square, is demonstrated by, or is to be demonstrated by, the aphelia being at rest. That's what Newton did. He did not rely on the ellipse to infer the inverse square. He relied on the non-precession of the planets. And as Euler said, and we've all known for a long time, this is the most sensitive measure of the inverse square. Calandrino, very properly, goes in his notes, gives you the current values for what the rate of that precession is. Unfortunately, all of those values are about 10 times too large. And the reason is very simple. It's hard to separate the precession of an orbit from the wobble of the Earth. It took a long while to get those clear. On the other hand, the important thing he says at the bottom on the right-hand side is he says, nevertheless, the aphelia are at rest quam proxime. Quam proxime is a word that occurs 137 times in the Principia. It is a word that Newton used constantly. Everywhere Newton draws an inference from phenomenon to any aspect of the law of gravity, he always has proven an if-then statement that doesn't have to hold exactly the form I'm describing it. If P quam proxime, then Q quam proxime. Okay? So what he does is actually live with the fact that none of the classic astronomical rules hold exactly, but he looks for cases where he can infer if the orbit is almost stationary, then at least it's almost inverse square. Okay. He then says, and this is his word in Latin, is habere, take these things to be either accurate or quam proxime true, quoting now, until yet other phenomena make such propositions either more accurate or liable to exceptions. And this is my remark, the really major evidence for Newtonian gravity then came for the next two centuries from residual phenomenon deviations from Kepler. The term residual phenomenon is not mine, it's John Herschel's and Mary Somerville's. So by the 1830s, it was at what I just said up there is absolutely clear to at least two people, and William Ewell picks it up from the two of them. In all fairness, Mary Somerville was very close in intellectually with John Herschel, so Herschel should get the primary credit doubtlessly. Anyway, that's what Newton actually did. When you look at why he didn't think you could infer the inverse square from the ellipse, even before he had gotten away on the Principia, when he first looked at this, he asked the obvious question. Namely, suppose indeed Jupiter, Saturn, the Earth, and Venus orbits are all indistinguishable between a eccentric circle and an ellipse. Can I still infer the inverse square safely? So he developed this proposition. You can see how the force varies. It's 1 over sp squared times pv cubed. Which when you expand, I'm the one who did the formula at the bottom, simply expanding what Newton did, there's not an inverse square in sight. It goes inversely as a combination of fifth power, third power, first power, minus one power. So Newton knew in middle of 1684, you can't infer inverse square from the ellipse and it hold quam proxime. Doesn't hold at all quam proxime, if it's only quam proxime and ellipse. In both the Principia and in Liber Secundus, the original version of Book 3, the first time the word ellipse occurs in Book 3 or anywhere in Liber Secundus is after he's derived the full law of gravity and used it to establish the Copernican system. Then for the first time he mentions ellipse. It's just not there beforehand. And what he says about it is quite striking. About the sun, liberated in this way, the other planets revolve in elliptical orbits, and by radii drawn to the sun, describe areas proportional to the times very nearly, as has been shown, as has been explained. I'll just comment about the word explain. Nowhere in any form of the Principia, including all of Newton's notes in it, does he ever use the word explanare. It's either exposit or explicate. Okay? He just doesn't use the word. In Proposition 65, if the sun were at rest and the planets did not act on one another, the orbits would be elliptical and the areas would be proportional to the times exactly. I'll come back to that. Continuing, if the sun were at rest and the planets had no action among one another, their aphelion nodes would also be at rest, and the major axes of the elliptical orbits would be as the cube roots of the squares of the periodic times, and thus would be given. Moreover, astronomical observations appear to confirm that the aphelia advance very slowly and the nodes regress. So he's got subjunctives on both the stationary character of the orbits and the ellipse. And in his mind, subjunctives are great because you can prove them empirically. You prove them empirically by showing every deviation from them has a physical cause totally consistent with Newtonian gravity. And that's the subsequent history of gravitation research, doing case after case of deviations from his subjunctive and showing that they agree with Newtonian theory down to Einstein. Einstein preserved almost all of the conclusions reached with Newton, but just extended. So that's the vision. So how bad is it that she misrepresented Newton in this? Well, at the time, the effect almost had to be to draw a less sharp distinction between the way Newton wanted to do science and the way it was being done. And what I don't know if she had a copy of the optical lectures that had been published in Newton's lifetime. If so, she did read this. If not, she did not. What people underestimate is the extraordinary extent to which Newton held in contempt virtually all work being done in natural philosophy around him. And I do mean contempt. He had an extraordinarily low regard for it. This particular quote comes from the optical lectures when he was less than 30 years old. I'm not going to quote do the whole quote. I'm going to start halfway down. I therefore urge geometers to investigate nature more rigorously and those devoted to natural science to learn geometry first. Hence, the former shall not entirely spend their time in speculations of no value to human life, nor shall the latter, while working assiduously with a preposterous method, perpetually fall short of their goal. But truly, with the help of philosophical geometers and geometrical philosophers, instead of the conjectures and probabilities that are being blazoned about everywhere, we shall finally achieve a science of nature supported by the greatest evidence. That last sentence is what Newton is all about. Alan Shapiro and I have been saying that for a long time. He is trying to create a science of nature supported, and notice the word is scientia, supported by the greatest evidence. That's what she's obscured by doing that. Why did she do it? I don't know. I'm not going to go through this list. I'm throwing it out to De Chatelet scholars. I don't know why she did it. I have to conclude she did not understand what Newton was trying to do, and in particular the extent he was depending on forward-looking evidence. Did it have any effect on her commentary on science? Probably not. I think, however, and now I'm in Judith's position of offering a hypothesis, I think, however, it had a very substantial effect on philosophy of science. Pierre Duhem, in his Aim and Structure of Physical Theory, berates Newton for not having a method, for claiming he had a method when he definitely did not have a method. What's Duhem's argument? Newton presupposed Keplerian motion, including the ellipse, derives a law that then entails Keplerian motion is false. You can't derive from a hypothesis a principle that then refutes it. Therefore, Newton had no method. Karl Popper goes more extreme. being saying, of course Newton did hypothetico-deductive. He just misrepresented himself in the Principia. Lakatos, in a posthumous work, took it a step further. He said Newton openly lied in claiming he had a new method in the Principia. So we have this whole 20th century tradition of Newton did not have a method. And I, for 30 years teaching Duhem, I have told students I have no idea where Duhem got the idea that Newton derived the inverse square from the ellipse. Now, thanks to Jean-Marie, I think I have a very good idea. Namely, he read the Principia in French, he read her commentary, and he decided she was right when the book just gives zero evidence for that. Okay? I don't want to go too long. That's the worst thing I'm going to say about her. I don't know why she did that. When it comes to getting the mass of the attracting body, she had the advantage of having both books in front of her. So in the Principia, what Newton does in order to get that is simply stipulate the third law of motion holds for gravitation forces. Then he shows both by experiment and from celestial phenomenon that the gravity has to be proportional to the mass of the attracted body. And then using the third law of motion concludes that it's also proportional to the mass of the attracting body with the corollary, its gravity is composed out of inverse square gravitational forces toward its parts. That's not at all what he did in Liber Secundus. What he did there was to first note the agreement between the force of gravity and the size of the attracting planets, namely Saturn, Jupiter, Earth, and the Sun, suggests, the word is an analogium, as you see, that agreement led him to look at the question of whether or not force of gravity is proportional to the mass of the attracted body. He does do a beautiful job deriving that. You'll see her noting it in a moment. And then he says, and I want you to notice the phrasing, and since the attraction of centripetal force upon the attracted body at equal distances is proportional to the matter in this body, it is reasonable also to grant that it is proportional as well to the matter in the attracting body. It is reasonable to grant. Okay, that's not empirical evidence. Okay, and she could not have missed it because she uses this very similar word in her describing the situation. She too starts from the fact that Jupiter and Saturn at conjunction are in mutual attraction to one another, and the moon on the Earth from the tides. In fact, she's mistaken about the Jupiter-Saturn. Newton said that it was perceptible that when they were in conjunction, they disturbed one another's orbits. Euler, in the 1748 prize-winning essay on Jupiter and Saturn that I listed up there earlier, showed that the effect when they're at conjunction is nearly negligible. It's very, very small. So that left Jupiter-Saturn as a complete mystery till 1785, when Laplace discovered it's a 900-year fluctuation, that it's not something happening at conjunction. So this is a case that tells me she did not know the Euler Prize-winning essay of 1748, because it's quite clear in that it's not new. But that's an aside. We can therefore conclude that the attractive force belongs to all the celestial bodies. Then she notes the same thing Newton does in Liber Secundus, the relation to size, and now quoting, seeing as the size and mass are two different things, in order to be sure that gravity follows the law of masses, it was therefore necessary to know these masses. Because the attraction of all celestial bodies that surround them follows the inverse proportion of the square of the distances, it is quite likely that the parts of which they are composed attract each other in the same proportion. And then she starts arguing, I'm not going to quote this, you can read it for yourself. She starts arguing that the mass toward the whole, the gravity is proportional to the mass of the whole because it's proportional to the parts. In fact, she ends up this wonderful thing, I will quote it. If we imagine that several little planets unite to make a big one, the force of this big planet would be composed of the forces of all these little planets, and therefore you get the mass. It's interesting to see other people's reaction to the problem Newton had. Newton went back in the late part of 1685 and added a whole series of propositions, one of which is Proposition 92, that gives an experimental program by which you can establish that the gravitation is proportional to the mass of the attracting body. We finally did that in the 19th century. That is, the first evidence that that's actually true comes from the 1850 to 1900, actually doing that experiment. More interesting, though, is what Euler says in a letter to Mayer, and happens to be Christmas Day, December 1751. It is still not decided by any single phenomenon that the attractive forces of heavenly bodies are proportional to their masses. On the contrary, Newton tried to determine the masses on this basis, since there is no other way of specifying them. As soon as one now places the statement that the attractive forces are proportional to the masses, which is founded on a crude hypothesis, the third law of motion applying to gravity, in doubt, and then he says, my new approach to gravity can be carried forward. So this was recognized. This was recognized by Euler, the leading proponent of Newtonian theory, that he did not have any grounds for saying that it was mass mass of the attracting body in the numerator. I think she picked up on that quite a bit. Next, what about the attracted body? Well, what she does is she inverts the order that Newton seems to have discovered this, judging from the 1685 work. She says, first of all, experiment near the Earth is going to show that the gravitational forces act in proportion to the mass of the attracted body. And she cites the Boyle feather and gold experiment in a vacuum. By then, Desaguliers had done it at a much larger scale. She may not have known that. And then Newton's own experiments, the first of the Otvos experiments to confirm, in his case, he said within one part in a thousand, that the force of gravity acts on all bodies the same in the vicinity of the Earth. And then she lays out very nicely the celestial argument for it. As always, when she paraphrases something, it's wonderfully clear. The reason I quoted that whole paraphrase was because she cites Proposition 65, Corollary 3, which is one of the most important propositions in the whole of the Principia. It gives you necessary and sufficient conditions for treating our solar system as isolated from the rest of the universe. And she's one of the very few people I've ever seen cite it, so I'm very impressed that she cites it. And you can read the rest. What I wanted to call your attention to here is she uses a phrasing that, when I read Jean-Marie's translation, I read it and said, does she really see this? What upset Newton terribly about the idea of gravity acting in proportion to the mass of the attracted body is the following. First law of motion says forces are external, acting on a body, causing it to change motion. Gravity is an external force acting on a body that adjusts itself to every body. How can it be external and adjusting itself to every body? That, it's now called the equivalence principle, that drove Newton, as far as I can see, into including the other mass and saying it's interactive. It's not an external phenomenon at all. It's internal to the two bodies. What stunned me when I saw this is her verb, proportions itself. That's exactly the right description of the equivalence principle. The equivalence principle is a modern Einsteinian phrase. But it's an extremely disturbing aspect about gravity. It bothered Newton, it bothered Einstein, and she picked up on it fully. And, you know, I was stunned. All right, with that, I want to do a couple more things and then not keep you any longer. She treats the precession of the equinoxes, which I've already told you, D'Alembert, roughly at the time she died, had announced that Newton had no solution at all. She presents it accurately according to the text of Newton. There's no complaints there. What Newton does is he does not treat the Earth as a rigid body in motion. He treats instead the protuberance of the Earth as a ring, and then does an analogy with the motion of the nodes of the moon. And as D'Alembert points out, what we would call, he totally fails to recognize the conservation of angular momentum. In general, in the Principia, everywhere Newton is doing anything involving angular momentum, he does it wrong. OK? Johann Bernoulli said in 1730, he just doesn't understand the principle of the lever. And it's a legitimate criticism. All right, that's the reason it's not a solution at all. But what I want you to notice is she correctly describes what he does. He derives the effect of the sun on this protuberance of the Earth, treating it as if it were in analogy with the moon. And then he has to put in the effect of the moon. And this is quoting her. Now add the action of the moon, quote, which is to that of the sun as 4.4815 approximately. That's a five significant figure number to which she attached the word approximately. Newton does not attach the word approximately. That's a number that's a sham. Okay, he couldn't come up with the right number. He asked Coates to give him a number that would work. Coates gave him 4.5. He then changed it to a five significant figure number. Okay. And you notice in the Liber Secundus, that number is 5 1/3. And in the first edition, it's 6 1/3, okay? He doesn't have a means of getting the lunar force, and he knows it, okay? What's striking about that is when you turn to what she says about the action of the moon and the sun on the tides, I'll let you read the first quote on your own. She very nicely points out that the tides are a total mess. And what Newton has done is taken a giant step forward to sorting them out by being able to distinguish the lunar and the solar effect. And then she gets to the point of talking about the force of the moon, and she drops the 4.4815. It's her number, 4.5. So she's already recognized that 4.4815 is not a legitimate number, and she's not going to use it for anything. And then she turns to the Bernoulli, there were three prize-winning essays in 1740 on the tides. They're on my first slide. Daniel Bernoulli, Euler, and McLaurin. Monsieur Daniel Bernoulli adds that the heights of the tides in the ports where observations are made depend on some many accidental circumstances, so many, that they cannot be exactly proportional to the heights of the tides far at sea. He concludes that it would be surer to evaluate the respective forces of the sun and the moon on the tides by their duration and their intervals rather than by their heights. And by using this method, finds that the force of the moon is in a lesser proportion to that of the sun than the one Mr. Newton found. Indeed, the number Bernoulli gives is 2.5 to 1. She does not give it at this point in the commentary, but when she gets to the equations in the analytical part, she uses 2.5 to 1. She uses the Bernoulli number. So she's taking the Bernoulli number seriously. Why didn't she conclude the Newton solution for the precession is a sham? I don't know. Maybe she's too polite. Maybe she was just not confident enough. But it's sitting there. When you look at these forces and get the Bernoulli number, you know there's something badly wrong. D'Alembert did not work from the Bernoulli number. He worked from Bradley's nutation, which happens to be the same number, 2.5 to 1. The correct number is 2.15, if anybody cares. All right, let me end with four slides in which I think Du Châtelet looks remarkably good, stunningly good. The first one, she summarizes, but it's at a length that if I had quoted her, I would have had too many slides. So instead, I've just summarized it myself, but all of this is in her except the equation I show. So let me just read it out for those who don't know this. Newton deduced that if the Earth is in hydrostatic equilibrium and gravity toward it arises from inverse square gravity toward its individual parts, then the ratio of its polar diameter to its equatorial diameter is 229 over 230, and surface gravity decreases from the pole of the Earth to the equator by 0.21%, so long as its density, the Earth's density, is uniform. Newton further proposed that if the decrease in gravity is greater than this, the Earth's density increases toward the center and its flatness is greater than one part in 230. Clairaut in 1738, to the contrary, a flatness of 1 over 230 is a maximum value under the stated assumptions, and that if the decrease in gravity from pole to the equator is greater than 0.21%, The density does indeed increase toward the center, and its flatness is less than 1 over 230. Clairaut in 1743, if the Earth is in hydrostatic equilibrium and gravity toward its parts rises from inverse square gravity toward its individual parts, misstated, but that's what the text is right, then the Earth is a spheroid, and there is a systematic relationship between its flatness and the decrease in surface gravity from pole to equator. Neither Clairaut nor she gives the modern form of the formula, but I'm giving it. It's in virtually any geophysics textbook called Clairaut's theorem. And now the point, assuming that the Earth is in hydrostatic equilibrium, then the claim that its gravity arises from inverse square gravity toward its parts, and with it, Newton's claim of universal gravity can be tested by seeing whether the two coincide. Now I go to just quotes from her. This great question of the figure of the Earth depends on the law according to which primitive gravity acts. We were obliged to go measure a degree beneath the equator and another beneath the polar circle to decide this question. The measures taken in Lapland and Peru give a greater flattening than the one that we have just seen results from Newton's theory, for these measures give the ratio of the axes 173 to 174. Just in case anybody misses it, Newton's theory of gravity is totally inconsistent with the actual measurements. Okay. Continuing, it follows from Mr. Clairaut's theory that by admitting the suppositions that he makes on the interior of the Earth as the most natural among those that present themselves to the spirit, that's the hydrostatic equilibrium, that the flattening can never be greater than 229 to 230, seeing as this ratio is the one we find while supposing the Earth to be homogeneous, and that it results from this theory that in all other cases of the gravity increasing, the flattening must be less. So she announces this is inconsistent. Finally, in the experiments that have been carried out since Mr. Newton on the length of the pendulum, in the different regions of the Earth, prove that these differences must not be attributed to the cause Newton wanted to assign them to, namely thermal expansion, and that, quote, there really is a decrease in gravity from the pole to the equator greater than the one that Mr. Newton gave in his table. So far as I know, this is the clearest statement of the irreconcilability of Newtonian theory with the figure of the Earth and the measurements of surface gravity anywhere in the literature before Laplace resolves the problem at the end of the century. It's just beautifully done. Now, how much of it came out of conversation with Clairaut and how much of it is her, I can't tell, but the phrasing looks absolutely like hers. Okay, so the most she did was put it in her own words quite brilliantly. I don't know anywhere Clairaut put it this clearly. All right, last topic, the moon. I've got a couple of long quotes. The different kinds of motion that we had noticed long ago in the moon and the laws of these motions found by famous astronomers gave Mr. Newton the means of applying with success his theory to this planet. This great man, who had already made so many discoveries in the other parts of his system of the world, still wanted to perfect this one. And although the method he followed at this occasion is less clear and less satisfying than the one he had used for the other phenomena, we cannot prevent ourselves from owing him much recognition for having applied himself to it. So what she mean, less clear, less satisfying? Mr. Newton, after having exposed the method by which he calculates the moon's inequality that is called the variation, the method he follows while determining the motion of the nodes, and the variation of the obliquity from the ecliptic, gives an account of what he says he has drawn from his theory of gravitation with regards to the other inequalities of the moon. In the examinations of the first inequalities, although the reader is not extremely satisfied because of a few suppositions and of a few abstractions made to make the problem easier, namely Newton's working throughout with a circular orbit, doing perturbations on it, there is at least this advantage, that he sees the reader, that is, sees the path of the author, and he acquires new principles with which he can flatter himself to go further. But as to that which regards the motion of the apogee and the variation of the eccentricity, stop for a moment. The apogee swings from anywhere to, have to do this, 12 degrees forward to 9 degrees backward on any one revolution, and the eccentricity has this wobble. That's what she's referring to. Bouillot called it the evection. It was discovered by Ptolemy. Of all other inequalities of the motion of the moon, Mr. Newton contents himself with the results that are convenient for the astronomers in the construction of tables of the moon's motion, and he assures that his theory of gravity led him to the results. In other words, he just tells astronomers what to do calculationally. He gives no evidence for how it was derived from gravity. And she goes on to say, but how did Mr. Newton use these alterations to the central force, and which principles did he follow to avoid or to conquer the extreme complexity and the extreme difficulties of the calculation presented by this research? This is what we have not yet been able to discover, at least not in a satisfactory way. We find, I admit, in the first book of the Principles, a proposition on the general motion of the apsides, which promises initially great usages for the theory of the apsides of the moon, but when we come to use it, we soon see that it does not advance us much in this research. That's the proposition I showed you of hers doing the superposition of the inverse cube. That's the one she's referring to. Now, and these are the final words of her on the moon, and they are extraordinary. We cannot, without new contrivances that could be as difficult to find as the entire determination of the orbit of the moon, use Mr. Newton's general proposition on the apsides for the case of the moon. Also, on this article, the rest of the theory of the moon, the rest of the theory of the moon, I think I just left a word out there, sorry. The greatest geometers of this century abandon the path beaten by Mr. Newton's commentators up to the present and believe that they would arrive earlier at the goal by retaking the whole work starting right from its origin. That was true of Clairaut, it was true of Euler, it was true of D'Alembert, but I don't know how she could have known it of anybody but Clairaut, unless Clairaut told her about Euler, and D'Alembert and Clairaut were not communicating to one another. They were intense enemies. But now let's just finish this. They, these great geometers, look to determine directly the paths and the speeds of any three given bodies that attract each other. We flatter ourselves in soon seeing the success of their work. The analytic method that they follow seems to be the only one that could really satisfy a research of this nature. In the same year she died, Clairaut succeeded with the motion of the moon, using an analytical approach, going to higher order perturbations. And if you ask the question, was there one single event in the development of evidence from the Principia that caused geometry to be removed from celestial mechanics? I've just given it to you. Okay. And it's remarkable that she's seeing geometry's a dead end. Thank you.